This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's countdown time again. Our film critic Stephen Schiff is with us with his list of the 10 best films of 1994. You might want to jot these down. Some of his favorite films may still be playing at a theater near you. Others you might want to rent when they come out on video. Why don't we start with number 10 on Stephen's list and work our way up?
Number 10 is Natural Born Killers, Oliver Stone's very controversial avant-garde story of two killers who are in love and on the lam. Number 9 is To Live by Zhang Yimou, the Chinese film that covers about 3 or 4 decades of Chinese life under Mao. Number 8 is Lady Bird, Lady Bird, which is Ken Loach's kind of searing, harrowing indictment of the British social services system, with a great performance by a newcomer named Chrissy Rock, probably, in my opinion, the female performance of the year. Number 7 is Quiz Show, Robert Redford's surprisingly good film about the quiz show scandals of the 50s, starring Ralph Fiennes and John Turturro. The next one is very obscure. It really only played in New York, in fact, for something like 3 weeks at one little theater, and didn't get to much of the rest of the country, and I thought it was an extraordinarily good film. It's called L627. It's a policier by Bertrand Tavernier that really gets at the grit of police work and the banality of police work in a way that many American films have tried to do but have not succeeded as well as I think Tavernier has. Then Nicholas Heitner's The Madness of King George, which is Heitner is making his film debut as a director, but he directed The Madness of George III on the stage, and this is the film adaptation of it, starring Nigel Hawthorne, who starred in it on the stage, Alan Bennett's great play, made even better as a film. Number 4 is Hoop Dreams, the extraordinary nearly 3-hour documentary about two kids in the Chicago ghetto, a film made by Steve James, Frederick Marks, and Peter Gilbert. Number 3, Vanya on 42nd Street, Louis Malle's version of Andre Gregory's version of the Chekhov play, and a really sublime piece of movie making. Number 2, The Boys of St. Vincent by John N. Smith, Canadian director. And this film began for Canadian television and is a two-part film amounting to about 3 hours about a scandal, in a semi-fictional scandal in a seminary and that involves child abuse. And it's an extraordinary piece of straight-ahead narrative filmmaking with a chilling performance by a newcomer named Henry Czerny. And number 1, this may not surprise people, but it really is a towering movie, I think, Pulp Fiction by Quentin Tarantino.
Stephen, I'll bet you that a lot of our listeners have only seen 2 or 3 movies on your list, even very serious film goers, because a lot of these movies have never opened in a lot of places or haven't yet opened in many places.
I feel a little embarrassed about that, too. I
didn't mean to embarrass you.
That's all right. Oh, I'm blushing like crazy. I'm like a rose in here. No, I'm sorry about that, and I think there are 2 reasons. 1, this is a very peculiar Christmas this year. We have a lot of films that opened that would ordinarily have opened around Christmas, opening very early in November, as Hollywood races to sort of get a bigger piece of the year-end pie and realizes that things are not quite so seasonal as Hollywood has traditionally made them. So that you had movies like Star Trek and Interview with a Vampire and Junior, big sort of year-end blockbusters opening before Thanksgiving. That made the Christmas season seem sparser, and a lot of the Christmas films were, as they say in the business, platformed, which means they open very slowly so that word of mouth gets to build and build and build, and then they go wider into more theaters in January. That's true of The Madness of King George, for instance, on my list. Some of these films are foreign films, like To Live and Lady Bird, Lady Bird, which is not a foreign language film, but which is a small British film, that will open very, very gradually all over the country. So yes, that's the problem. And some of them, like The Boys of St. Vincent, are doomed to remain obscure because of the subject matter and their length.
So I should say to our listeners that if there are films on this list that you haven't seen that you want to see, they might be opening up in January in a theater near you.
That is right.
All right. Well, Stephen, I'll tell you what, there's a lot more I want to talk with you about 1994 in film. But why don't we take a short break first?
Fine.
This is Fresh Air. Back with Fresh Air film critic Stephen Schiff, who's also a critic at large for The New Yorker, and we're looking at the year 1994 in film. I've noticed lately that a lot of the art houses, where you used to see mostly foreign films, you're now seeing a mix of foreign films and of independent films. independent American films. And more, I think those art houses are given over to the independent American films.
Yeah, I think that's right. And even when you do see foreign films, they're very often not foreign language films. They're English speaking films, although they're from England or from Ireland or from Australia. And this was a discovery that was made sort of in the mid-80s by foreign film distributors who were even then dwindling in number, which is that America does have an appetite for foreign films, but not for foreign language films. That appetite is tiny. And it must be said that the world cinema has also contracted, and you know, you could do a chicken or the egg kind of analysis. In other words, has the audience contracted and therefore the cinemas have contracted, or is it just that there aren't very good filmmakers out there right now and therefore the audience has contracted? It's hard to say, but if you look at the French film industry, which once was an extraordinarily dominant influence, it's dwindled. If you look at Italian films, that's dwindled. The Japanese film industry is nearly dead. The Chinese film industry, of course, is a very important new influence, but it's a deeply embattled one. We're not getting much in the way of Indian films. Et cetera, et cetera. The great German Renaissance is long over. So that's a sad state of affairs. And then when the films do come, they seem to have a limited and shrinking audience. That audience that delighted in foreign films many years ago is aging and is not being replaced by younger people. So you now have a situation where films that speak English, whether they're American independents or foreign films that speak English, are going into the art houses alongside the foreign films, and then they're tested there, and if they find an audience, those independent films move on to larger venues, and at the same time, their directors get seduced into the big Hollywood machine.
And it seems that Hollywood is scouting these young independent filmmakers more and more, and that they're getting scooped up more quickly than ever before by Hollywood when they're successful.
Even the ones that we haven't heard of. I mean, The Boys of St. Vincent, my number two pick of the year, by John N. Smith. I mean, maybe he made that name up, but actually there is a real John N. Smith who's been working on a very small scale in Canada for many years. The Boys of St. Vincent didn't go all over the country. It didn't get wide regard and acclaim, but John N. Smith, friends of his tell me, has just finished coming back from Disney and making a Michelle Pfeiffer movie. So the studios are on the lookout for new talent, and there are two sides to that coin. I mean, maybe it's not a coin, and maybe there are more sides to it. It's very nice to have young, exciting new filmmakers get opportunities and get paid and get famous. That's terrific. And if they can handle it, and if they can go back and forth, as someone like Quentin Tarantino says he would like to do, go back and forth between independent cinema and big blockbuster mainstream cinema, depending on what's appropriate for the topic of his film, that is just great. And I hope we can work that out. But very often what happens is someone is sucked into the giant maw and goes through a series of compromises and pretty soon doesn't know what's happened to him. That happened the first time, for instance, Neil Jordan came to Hollywood. He started making very bad Hollywood movies. Interview with a Vampire is not a movie I think very highly of, but it's at least more accomplished than what he made before returning back to England and Ireland and making The Crying Game on his own terms and then finding his own success again. That's one thing that happens. Another thing is that these young directors who are from the independent world are kind of fodder for the system because the age of the great auteur is sort of over in Hollywood. It's now the age of the lawyers, the accountants, the money men, the conglomerates, even the producers more than the directors. And it seems more and more possible to make films with a director who is basically a traffic director, a guy who you get out there, he knows something about the camera, he's made a film that's good and interesting, but that's not what you want him for. You want him there because someone needs to be the director, and this guy's cheap, and this guy's easy to manipulate, and he's not going to jockey for power, and he's not going to make something too stylish, and he's not going to make something that is going to deviate from the mainstream. So it's a way of crushing the life out of people who may potentially develop into bigger talents if they stay away from Hollywood.
I think a lot of producers believe that the only way you can make a big movie is if you have a bankable star. But this is one of those years where even the bankable stars aren't always bankable. Who are some of the stars that had the big names but didn't get the big box office this year?
Well, you know, I mean, this idea of movie stars is always so funny because every year, you know, wise men sort of say, you know, there are only four movie stars and they're this guy and this guy and this guy and this guy. Then the next year, all those guys flop and they say, you know, now there are only really four movie stars. And so, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger flopped in Junior as he had flopped in Last Action Hero the previous year. Kevin Costner flopped and flopped and flopped in Wyatt Earp in The War. Julia Roberts flopped in I Love Trouble. Stallone, I don't know whether people still think he's a star, but I mean, it was that kind of year. Some stars did not flop. Tom Hanks did not. Tom Cruise did not. But I thought it was very possible that Tom Hanks could show up in a movie that, you know, people didn't want to see him in and he could go down the tubes and just his name on a marquee wouldn't mean anything. And that's the definition of what a star is. A star is someone who just by the appearance of that name on a marquee is going to draw you in. And it seemed to me that there was only one star, therefore, this year.
Who would that be?
And that was Jim Carrey, of all people. Now, Jim Carrey is a really strange phenomenon. He was in three hit movies this year, and last year he was in nothing. He hadn't even occurred yet. I've been sort of watching him on television and whatnot for a long time, and I'm fascinated by him. You know, if this is a year that in some ways celebrates dumbness, and certainly, you know, the year's big movie was Forrest Gump, a movie about how nice it is to be dumb. Jim Carrey is a little bit the flip side of that. He's always playing a dumb guy, but he's also playing a kind of shrewdly dumb guy. He's a sort of a rubber-faced shtick comic in a long tradition that goes back to, you know, Harpo Marx, Joey Brown, and Jerry Lewis. And like all those comics, his stock in trade is anarchy. But I think what makes him kind of our rubber face, you know, or a rubber face for the 90s, is that he's ironic. He's facetious. He is, you know, Jerry Lewis, Joey Brown, these guys were not facetious. They were, you know, what you saw was what you got. Like David Letterman, Jim Carrey is so knowing, is so kind of in on the joke with you, so self-reflexive. That is a very fin de siècle 90s thing. And I think it may portend well for him. I think he may last.
The box office phenomenon of the year was Forrest Gump. What do you make of the success of that film?
Well, from the moment we all saw it, and I saw it very early, I said, I see, this isn't a film, this is a religion. And I think that's really what was happening. And why this religion? I think what Forrest Gump says is, okay, let's go through the decades that we of the baby boom generation have gone through. We go through the 50s, we go through the 60s, we go through the 70s, we go through the 80s, and we see what rocked us and what sort of assaulted us and how difficult everything was and how impossible to digest everything was. And we all feel that. That's something that an entire generation and beyond shares in common. And at the same time, We see people around us sort of all the time being pundits about these things, telling us what to think, telling us what opinions we should have, telling us information we didn't have. We're in an information age, and that information is important. We see people around us who are very glamorous, who seem to have presided over these, you know, cataclysmic events in a way that we feel inadequate to. So all around us are these things that we are not equal to, and these people whom we are not equal to, and we feel overwhelmed. And then along comes a movie that says, hey, forget the whole thing. You can be dumb. You can be stupid. You can be you can be dumb as long as you're decent. And if you are decent and if you are nice, then love will come, riches will come. You don't have to understand a thing. Just go with the flow. Just be sweet. I think that's a kind of a message of salvation and redemption for a not very ambitious public, and it worked.
I don't imagine that you're going to a movie on New Year's Eve.
No, I'm actually not going to a movie on New Year's Eve.
No, you'd have to be taking notes if you did.
<That's>
Wouldn't
right.
be fun at all.
Wouldn't not necessarily.
Well, for those of us who plan on staying home and renting videos, do you want to maybe talk about some of your favorite films of all time that just might be available on video?
Oh, my favorite films of all time. Well, this is always hard. And if someone asks me, and many people do ask me, what my favorite film is, it changes week by week. This week I'm in a mood for Seven Samurai. That is one of the greatest films of all time and could occupy you for many happy New Year's Eve hours.
Just be warned, it's subtitled. If you're watching it on video,
it's a little hard
to read.
A lot of what I'm about to name is because the next one I was going to say was Rules of the Game. I mean, if you can't go to a New Year's Eve party, The best party on film is Rules of the Game. I mean, it is just, well, it's just magic from start to finish.
So what are you doing New Year's Eve, Stephen?
I'm partying, babe.
Well, have a really good time.
Same to you, Terry.
Happy New Year.
Thanks.
And thanks for talking about the year in film with us.
Pleasure.
Stephen Schiff is Fresh Air's film critic, and he's critic at large for The New Yorker. Let's hear the now famous twist scene from Pulp Fiction, Stephen's pick for the best film of the year.
Ladies and gentlemen, now the moment you've all been waiting for, it's a world famous Jack Rabbit Slim's twist contest. Now let's meet our first contestants here this evening. Young lady, what is your name?
Mrs. Mia Wallace.
And how about your fella here?
Vincent Vega.
All right, let's see what you can do. Take it away.
It was a teenage wedding and the old folks wished them well. You could see that Pierre did truly love the mademoiselle. And now the young monsieur and madame have rung the chapel bell. C'est la vie, say the old folks, it goes to show you never can tell.
This is Fresh Air.